History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should never go untold. And they don't have to if we're willing to do something about it, like ask some questions, take some time to listen, and if you do, get ready to be amazed by what you end up hearing. Our goal has always been to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we do find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. On our last episode, we had to leave you with a bit of a cliffhanger. 100-year-old Luke McLaurin of Memphis, Tennessee, had told us about his 20th and final mission as a B-24 bombardier with the 464th Bomb Group, flying out of Pantanella, Italy, as part of the 15th Air Force in World War II. He was able to parachute out of that doomed plane, but it was almost too late. He hit the ground really hard and was actually knocked unconscious. If you missed that episode, you can listen anytime at hometownheroesradio.com. When we left off, he had been interrogated by a German officer who knew everything about him. We're going to pick up the story from there.
From interrogation center, they sent us to a Red Cross camp, where they outfitted us with a regular United States Army overcoat and a scarf and a helmet cap, wool helmet cap. And incidentally, I was in Troop 8 Boy Scouts, and one of my friends was in the same troop. His name was Tom Young. And at that place, he and I met each other 4,000 miles away, POW camp, and here's two guys in the same Boy Scout troop.
Wow. Talk about a welcome sight, huh? Yeah. Your Boy Scout friend on the other side of the world. How many GIs do you think were at that Red Cross camp?
There were easily 200. Easy there, yeah.
So how'd you guys spot each other?
Well, we were called out for APPEL, which is the head count. And my middle name is Layton, Luke Layton. And Tom came up to me and he says, "Layton, is that you?" I said, "Tom, is that you?" Yeah. And he had actually gone down the same day I went down on a target at Innsbruck.
And I understand that meeting played a role in your parents finding out that you were alive?
That is correct. That's the way it was. We were allowed, the Germans allowed us, two postcards and one letter every month. Well, I didn't get there until just before Christmas of 44, so I didn't get that. And then there was January and then February, and none of my postcards nor my letters got home, but one of Tom's did. And the mailman came in the bakery waving the postcard like this. "Miss Mack, he's alive. He's a POW. Tom, one of Tom's had gotten through." And so instantly my mom called Ms. Young and told her that the mailman was coming.
So for everyone who's trying to follow along and maybe didn't catch it, the mailman, because this is a postcard, is reading it right there. He knows all y'all anyway. And before he even takes it to the family it's addressed to, he runs into the bakery to tell your mother.
Yes, that is correct. That's what he did.
What a you can't make stuff like this up.
It happened. It really did. Honest to goodness.
So they're elated that you're alive, but meanwhile, you're dealing with this uncertainty of the worst winter in European history, in a prisoner of war camp, not knowing when the war is going to end. How did you handle the day-to-day of that?
It's difficult. Mostly we did walking around the compound is what we did most of the time. And that's mostly what we did.
What did you have to eat? How'd you stay warm? I mean, things that we take for granted, I'm sure you couldn't.
Well, We had a small, very small stove. It was almost just extremely small. Anyway, and I was in a room in the barracks with 12 of us. There was one Belgian. I was from Memphis. There was a guy from Blytheville and one from Brooklyn. We were allowed that one cup of soup per day, which we all put in the central plots for all of us. The Red Cross, the Swiss Red Cross, would bring parcels and they would store them outside the compound, and we were allowed a half parcel per week for each person. Mm-hmm. So it was all shared, every bit of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we shared it all together. And incidentally, I was a baker. So when I got there just before Christmas Eve, I made cookies. The guys had saved up some of the stuff that was in the Red Cross parcels. There was sugar packets and instant coffee and cookies of some kind and cigarettes. Incidentally, they were to bribe the guards with. We didn't use those. Spam, chipped beef, and stuff like that in there. Mm-hmm. It was a carton about that size right there, which was about maybe 10 inches by 4 inches deep, something like that. So I made cookies.
How'd they taste?
Great. I'm a baker. I'm not going to tell you something bad, but I made it. We're not going to do that. So anyway, that's what we did. That's what we had to eat. Mm-hmm. And incidentally, the Belgian guy, he was man about your size. At least he was before he got shot down. He was shot up 5 different times, the aircraft. He made it back to his lines, our Allied lines, 3 times. 2 times he was captured, and once he escaped, and then he got shot down again. He really hated the Germans. Really, really, really bad. Yeah, yeah.
Understandably so. How did you deal with the uncertainty of not knowing if or when you're going to get out of there?
Well, we had a radio. Now, who had it, I have no idea. But we got BBC, and we could tell what was going on. Somebody always came around and told the information to us or to someone in one room, and then it would be dispersed that way. We knew what was going on, and we figured 6 months, and that's the way it turned out.
And you mentioned the cigarettes were for bribing the guards. What could you bribe the guards for? What were some of the things you acquired from them?
I can't really answer that. I don't know how they used them. I really don't. They were there. Somebody else took them and used them for whatever purpose they needed. But a radio was probably one of them. Yeah.
Which the radio probably had to be hidden beneath the floorboards or something like that so the Germans wouldn't confiscate it?
Oh, yeah. We had to get out of the barracks every day, and the Germans went through the barracks checking everything, always, every day. Never failed.
How cold did it get that winter?
It was cold. That was during the Battle of the Bulge, when the temperature was 0 and below. And yeah, it was extremely cold. Now, I was in the center compound, and I don't know why they called it the center compound, because we were out on the edge. I don't clue in on that one at all. Yeah.
How did the guards and the German personnel in the camp treat you?
Humane. That's about the best way I can say it. Mm-hmm. One of the guys there, I don't remember his name. That's all right, too. It's been a while.
Yeah.
But anyway, he asked me what rank I was. Not even second lieutenant. He said, "We've got a lot of those here." And he said, "And don't worry about it. For you, the war is over." But, buddy, he just did not know how bad it was going to be after this. it was not over for me. He may have been right about somebody else, but that was not my thought.
And, you know, you mentioned the soup. Did you have to eat that sawdust bread, too?
Oh, yeah. That's rye bread is all sawdust bread. Yeah. Black rye bread was, that's what we called it, sawdust bread. That's for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think some guys have referred to it as tree flour, which I don't think you stocked in the bakery back here in Memphis.
We didn't do that at our bakery. Sorry about that. No.
So, I mean, you told us 5'3", 135 pounds when you went in. If you spent 5 months in the prison camp, did you lose a little bit of weight?
When I was liberated, I weighed 98 pounds at Camp Lucky Strike at La Harve.
So, I mean, if we do the math of that, a third of your body weight gone. What kept you going? What kept you believing that you're going to survive this and get back home to see your family again?
My faith. I believe it, and I still do. Yeah. Absolutely. I've been there, and I've done that. The other part of it from then, from Stalag Luft 3, the rest of it was just as bad.
Well, let's hear it. Don't leave us hanging.
Well, the Russians started coming through, and evidently, according to the Geneva Convention, which the Germans were part of, incidentally, said you had to keep the POWs away from the front lines. I really think now, my number at Stalag Luft 3 was 8,970. That was how many we had there. But I believe that what the Germans didn't want us to do is the Russians free us and then they give us rifles to go back and start shooting again. Anyway, they started coming in, and actually we could hear the thunder of the guns going off. Mm-hmm. And when we left, we could almost hear the single guns. So they were close. They moved us out at night. I'm confused now still about what day it was or anything like that, but I think it was in February of 45. And we're not allowed to go to sleep that night. And so we marched that night. And incidentally, we were allowed to go into the Red Cross parcel building and get whatever we wanted to get. So I had the box that my overcoat came in. And so I had tied some twine to it and put some stuff in it. As I remember it, it was Spam. And that's all right, too. So we moved out at night, and our time to get out of there was about 2 a.m. in the morning. We marched that night, the next day, the next night, the next day, 2 days and three nights. And because it was dark the whole time, I kept falling on a sled runner, which is just a board that somebody had used. And I finally couldn't get up. So two guys came by and says, "Can you get up?" I said, "No." So they picked me up and threw me up on top of the German wagon, the one-horse wagon, that all of the German packs were on. That night we slept in a barn. By the time I got up in the morning, most of my food was gone. All I had left was some canned salmon. So for the rest of the time during the march, a whole 10-day march, I had canned salmon. And I had to open it with that little screwdriver, can opener, and eat with it because there was no food, no forks, no spoons, no plates. But anyway, I did it. I got it done. And so we marched the few days, a total of 10 days on the road. And it was freezing cold the whole time. It got to Spremberg, Germany. And that's where we were stopped and put on a train, a boxcar.
The old 40 and 8? Yeah.
40 and 8. One barrel. And it took 4 days, actually 4 nights. They wouldn't move us in the daytime because Allied aircraft would strafe the thing. And
how packed were you in that 40 and 8?
That was it, 40.
Yeah.
And incidentally, the first night that we're on there, they gave us one of those number 10 size cans of horse meat and the two for three of us. And the same two guys that had picked me up and threw me up on top of that wagon were the same two that I shared that with. And I stayed with them the rest of the time, which was amazing.
Have you ever wondered what would have happened to you if they didn't throw you on that wagon?
They might have shot me. Mm-hmm. Yeah. One guy I know of escaped or tried to escape by running into the woods, and the guard shot on the left side of him and then on the right side of him, and he says, "I quit." He can't get back. Because he knew that the guard didn't want to kill him, or he would have shot him the first time. So anyway, he went from Springburg to Nuremberg. And there again, I think it was Stalag Luft 11, but I'm not really sure now. I think it might have been Stalag 13, but it was west of Nuremberg.
All right.
And the Red Cross lost us because they didn't know where we were. So we didn't have any Red Cross parcels. So it just the standard thing, sawdust bread, two slices, and one little cup of soup. And I think there were about maybe 1,500 to 2,000 of us at that camp. And then we went, the Americans started coming through to Nuremberg. So the Germans moved us out of there again. And I think that was right around the 1st of April. Of 45, and that was really a straggle. Never inside at any time at that.
So you've already made it through one death march. You're in Nuremberg for a while, and now they're marching you again. And it seems like everything's going from bad to worse.
Actually, that's so true. But some guys were smart and had some white cloth of some sort. So whenever we stopped during the daylight hours, they would put a big sign up, POW, and it must have been about 6 or 7 feet high and wide so that the Allied aircraft could see what we were. And we had an escort at least once a day for 51 that would come over and see where we were. They knew where we were POWs, and they were just checking us out. And we were on the road for 18 days. The Germans allowed us to go into the fields where the Germans had planted crops, and we got turnips and rutabagas and things like that. And we walked under, at night, some of the electric lines, and they were putting so much power through those lines that they were turning white. It's white as can be. And every hair on your head and on your arms and on your legs just stood straight up. It really did. And we got down to Stalag 7A at Moosburg, and that's where we were liberated.
But that liberation did not come immediately. There was more for Luke to endure. It's time for our first break, but we'll hear more from this 100-year-old ex-prisoner of war when we come back, and also learn more about the organization that connected us to Luke, Forever Young Veterans. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties, and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 1,800 veterans will have seen their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously.
Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and the continuation of the prisoner of war story of 100-year-old Luke McLaurin of Memphis, Tennessee. November 16th, 1944 is the day he became a prisoner of war. By the spring of 1945, he had survived two forced marches in captivity and arrived at Stalag 7A in Moosburg, Germany.
And they didn't have any space for us in the barracks, so we were in a big white tent between two barracks. Right next to the fence, I was about the fifth one inside the tent. One night, just about incidentally, we weren't there long. I don't remember how many days we were there. But two nights before we were liberated, there was a honey wagon that came along outside the fence. That's where they pumped the latrines out and spread it on the fields for fertilizer, okay. But normally at night, we actually bring aircraft over and to make the air raid sirens go off, whether you had a bomb or not. Mm-hmm. And I never went on one of those missions. But yeah, we did that. But this night it was silent. There was no air raid. And this honey wagon came along right outside the fence there on that little dirt road. And all of a sudden there was a loud swish and a boom. Some Allied aircraft had thrown a rocket or a missile into it. And it shook me up. Brother, I shook for 30 minutes, and nobody laughed at me at all. But anyway, we didn't smell too good. And we didn't have any showers or anything like that. So anyway, liberated us on the 29th of April, 1945, early in the morning. And what I remember most was they shot, I learned later that they took down the cupola on the church. Well, that was because it was a good high spot. They could check on where everything was. So they always took those out. And I remember that the only one guy was hurt, and he got a bullet through his buttock. But that's bad enough. He probably couldn't sit down for a while. But anyway, by the time that tank went through the gate, which is just boards and barbed wire. That's all it was. Mm-hmm. You couldn't see it. POWs climbed all over that thing real quick. Years later, I found out that the tank commander, and he had let somebody come down inside the turret. And the guy that was in the turret and the commander of the tank were classmates at West Point. Yeah. And he's the guy that went down in and said the commander of the tank really knew how to fight a war. There was a shell here and a bottle of wine, and a shell here and a bottle of wine. He knew how to fight a war. Uh-huh. We heard the guns going off and the whistling going across. And we were there for about 2 days, and we had gotten outside and went over to the airfield, just a grass strip, that's all it was. And they came in with C-47s, DC-3s, mm-hmm. military style C-47, and they hauled us off, filled us up and took off in formation, and I think we had 12 aircraft, and landed at Nancy, however that's pronounced in French. Mm-hmm. And they said, if you wish to refuel, if you wish to get out and relieve yourselves, well, you could get out and do that. Nobody got off of that airplane. But nobody gonna get off that thing. Got to Le Havre, and they put us in a tent and talked to us, and said, we're going to feed you after you take your shower and get some clothes on. do not try to eat too much because it might hurt you. It'll hurt your tummy. Okay, that's for sure. So anyway, they put us in the shower and we had to stay in there for 30 minutes, soaping up, rinsing off, soaping up and rinsing off. And we took all of our clothes off and put them on a bonfire, including our shoes. And they gave us towels to dry off with. Had to throw the towels on the fire. And then they said you could go in the tent there, and it's a big tent that has clothes in there. Well, that's fine. The clothes that fit you and clothes that fit me. But they were all mixed up. But anyway, we finally got it all together, and they let us go down the line, the chow line, outside chow line, incidentally. And the guys on the far side just plopped that stuff down, and I couldn't eat all that. Six bites, and that's all I could take. And I was there for about 4 days, and then they put us on a Liberty ship at Le Havre and moved us over to England. Didn't get off the ship. We were going to be in a convoy. And the war ended on the 8th, and we were on the ship and in the mess hall. And incidentally, it's just picnic-type tables with the seats heading fore and aft, as they call it, fore and aft, front and back. And they said, now we're going to make the air raid siren go for the last time. And when it started off, every one of us went under the tables. We weren't paying attention really to what it was saying. But, oh, man. And we got back in convoy. I guess because they thought maybe some of the subs, the German subs, had gotten the information or something. Got back and saw the lady in New York Harbor. We waved at her. Went back to Camp Kilmer, which was the same camp we left on. Mm-hmm. And from there went to Atlanta. In Atlanta, they paid me. And I called my parents and told them I would be in Memphis the next morning on the train. And I was there, and I got off the train at Bunton Station, which is just in town, but not all the way downtown. My parents were there in the car. They didn't recognize me. So when the train started up, they started to go back down, to go downtown to try to pick me up, and I whistled loudly. So, Mom, Dad, here I am. Oh, had 90 days leave. So 2 days after I was home, my dad sent me downtown to the ration office with an attorney to get a bakery ration. My father had bought a bakery from a Japanese, Mr. Kuniwadi, and they had sent him to one of the camps. Although he had been here at least 60 years, he came over as a child. So I had a bakery while I was at home on a 90-day leave. And they kept extending the 90 days, you know. So that was middle of May. And so until the end of the war in August, I made donuts. Uncle Sam was still paying me. And incidentally, I got paid 6 months' pay down in Atlanta. So I had $325 times six. That's what I had.
So I mean, you told me how you baked cookies on Christmas Eve as a prisoner of war. So many of the POWs that I've interviewed over the years have shared that one of the things that they did to pass the time was they dreamed about the food that they would eat when they'd be free again. They'd make up whole menus in the POW camp. They'd think about this restaurant or that restaurant or this dish. It makes me wonder what a baker thinks about when he's stuck in those conditions.
Well, we had guys in the camp that had a pencil and a piece of paper, and they would write down this restaurant, where it is, what's the address, and what's the phone number. Yeah. No. I didn't have anything like that going on. I didn't.
And I guess that's the other follow-up. You use that secret recipe of Red Cross parcel ingredients to make those cookies as a POW. Have you ever recreated that recipe as a civilian?
One time, my youngest daughter's husband asked me to do that for it. And man, I had to go back years through my brain to come up with what I made. And I did make them. And it, right now, I don't remember what it is. Yeah, I did it for him.
And they were edible.
Oh, absolutely. He says, hey, they're really good. Well, wait a minute. I'm a baker. I can make anything good.
That's true.
That feeling when you finally realized you're actually a free man again. Can you describe that for us?
Not really. It was a grateful feeling, I'll tell you that. But other than that, I can't really describe it.
And you mentioned, I wanted to highlight again something you talked about on the ship coming home. You said it was May 8th, the war is over. So when they're playing the air raid siren, that's supposed to be a celebration, right?
Yes, that's supposed to be a celebration. And it scared the fool out of us.
That's one of the more unique VE Day stories I've heard. And then you mentioned waving to the lady in New York Harbor, the Statue of Liberty. Boy, after everything you'd been through.
I waved to her as we left, yeah. And I waved to her as we got back.
But I'm just thinking that what you went through in between changed your perspective a little bit when you saw her on the backside.
That is so true. Yes, sir.
Is that something that you've lived these last 8 decades a little differently because of the perspective you had from living in the absence of freedom for those months as a prisoner?
Most definitely, it changes the whole thing, really. You realize what other people have gone through, different people of color that have had all the problems and still having them. Yeah, absolutely, it changes all of it.
And I'm sure a lot of people have listened to you so clearly and vividly describe the journey you were on, and they probably lost count of the moments where they said, no way, how did he get through that? How did that happen? Is there an element of what you've lived that you still do a double take on and say, how in the world did I get through that?
Absolutely. After I got back home from getting out down at San Antonio, I got back and I joined the reserve. Active reserve. I like to fly. The war's over. There's not going to be any problems. Korea. I was in the active reserve. So, you are in the active reserve. Come back again. So I spent 21 months in active service in the United States. And there again, there was a problem. We jumped paratroopers up at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, and flew missions, hauling things. One of the missions was up at in Kansas. They had a flood up there, and the military airfield up there lost all their power. So we hauled generators up there and gasoline up there for them. Little did I know, 2 weeks later, I would be up there in B-29s. They said, you're a bombardier. You're not a navigator. You don't know how to navigate these planes all over the United States. Well, guess what? I had been doing it. All the bombardiers had navigation training, everything except Celestial. And our navigators taught the bombardiers Celestial. Mm-hmm. So we knew it all. That was a pretty good deal. One of the things we would do in the B-29s would fly against the radar sites. We were supposedly an electronics countermeasure. Mm-hmm. In other words, we should be able to jam the radar on the ground and in the enemy aircraft. We weren't too good at that. They always got to us. Yeah, but anyway, we did. They gave us a problem. Go down to Eglin Field down at, on the Gulf down there and spend 2 weeks down there training, flying against the radar sites. Well, that's great. That was the best deal we ever had as far as the service is concerned. Report in the morning at 7 a.m., fly for 4 hours, come back down. And if you didn't have anything to do, they turned you loose at 7 a.m. On the beach. So my wife and our children had two at the time, and our navigator and his wife and two children. We had a little party down on the beach every day for 2 weeks, which was the best deal that anybody ever had in the service. I guarantee that.
Well, it's a lot better than all those prison camps in Europe and the death marches. I guarantee you that. When you think back on all of this, I mean, 100 years, we can all hear how sharp you are. If they were sitting here with you like I am, they'd see how straight you stand and how well you get around. You've described an incredible story that, again, defies reason in many ways. So how do you reason it? How do you explain everything you've been through and the fact that you're still doing as well as you're doing?
Our Heavenly Father looks after us. I'm a Christian, and I do believe. And if that anti-aircraft shell didn't explode, that was his reasoning, not mine. That's for sure.
You know, one thing I didn't ask you about, when you mentioned your parents not recognizing you and getting ready to leave without you and you had to call them out, do you remember the looks on your parents' faces when you embraced after all those years?
Well, I don't remember that part of it. I think I was crying too much.
I think we all would be. And I don't want to wrap things up without hearing a bit of the reason we're here today. I wouldn't have had the privilege of meeting you without Forever Young Veterans and what they've been doing. You've been around that organization for a long time. Sounds like that's made a pretty big impact in your life, too. Can you help me understand how?
Most certainly. Norm, a few years back, we had an organization of just POWs that would meet at one of the restaurants. And there were actually 9 of us at the time. And there's not, what, but three, is it 2 or 3 of us now? I don't remember. 3, and then we've got one that's a NAM vet also.
Well, you're doing better than most places to have 3, I'll tell you that. So Forever Young Veterans said, hey, we want to do something special for you?
Yeah, that little lady over there said she wants to do something for all of us. And she has really helped hundreds of us in this Forever Young group. It's the fact that we could get together and say, okay, old friend, I'm glad to see you're still alive. That's a great thing. Yeah, yeah. Fabulous. She invited me to go to Italy with her. And I said, oh, I haven't lost anything over there. Why would I want to go back to Italy? I should have gone, but I didn't.
And you're even in this book they put together. I bet that was kind of fun, seeing yourself and your story in there with all these other veterans.
I'm glad they're all here, and I'm glad I'm still here, too. Mm-hmm. Don't have a clue why, but I guess the big guy upstairs knows what he's doing.
Well, let me ask you a couple questions about that. And if there's anything I haven't asked you about, you know, make sure, feel free to throw it in there. And one thing I don't want to forget to say is thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for sharing a story that there's no way we could ever hear anywhere else. Is there something you'd say you're most proud of or most thankful for when you take stock of that century on this planet?
Not really. I'm just one very small, very old man doing my job the way I think it should be done, and I try to do it right. That's it.
And you said you don't know what the guy upstairs is thinking and what he still has planned for you here, but is there anything you haven't done in these 100 years that might still be on your list that you're hoping to do one of these days?
Well, I was going to skydive at 100th birthday, but that didn't work. I can't see.
But you did go skydiving on your 95th birthday, a tandem jump. I've seen the video. I'll put that up online for everybody to check out. What kind of rush was that?
That was really great. Yes. When we first went out of the aircraft, incidentally, the guy tandem was your size. And she says he's got his pajamas on. But really, it wasn't just tight shorts or tight long pants. The free falling, and it was finally really, really good. And I got a big grin on my face, and then he popped the chute. And we came down, and it was great to be in the parachute for longer than 10 seconds. I found out what it was supposed to be like.
So was that the first time you'd opened a parachute since that abrupt 10-second descent into the Alps?
Yes, that was the last time I had, the only time I had done it. Just not just but sometime, but the one time. Yeah, yeah.
So 75 years later, you got it right.
I got it right. The guy behind me got it right. I'm glad he did. But anyway, I found out that with the parachutes that they have these days, it's a lot different. What we had, my chute was 24 feet wide. The backpack and the seat pack were 28 feet wide. But a little guy like me, I guess 24 feet was all I really needed.
And so you were saying, after that experience on your 95th with the tandem jump, you had the thought of, hey, when I hit the century mark, I'm going to do it by myself, no assistance necessary. But just like they derailed you telling you you're colorblind, they said your eyes aren't good enough?
Well, yeah, it's just my problem. It was so that I could not see the distances that I was from the ground. But anyway, these new chutes, or the ones they have now, it's just like flying an airplane. You come down and you make a downwind and then a base and then a final approach and you land right where you want to land. Whereas with that big round chute like that, you're coming down and the only way you can guide it is try to climb up some of the shroud lines, and that doesn't work too well.
Especially if you only have 10 seconds.
Yeah, but 10 seconds is not enough for my ears to ring out.
A story nobody else could tell from 100-year-old Luke McLaurin. We're not done yet. When we come back, more about the organization that connected us to Luke, Forever Young Veterans. The story of where the idea came from and the impact it's had is sure to touch your heart. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level. When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank. So the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-5555. 383328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. What a journey it's been the past couple episodes with 100-year-old ex-prisoner of war Luke McLaurin of Memphis, Tennessee. If you caught our last episode, you heard Diane Height introduce Luke. She is the founder of Forever Young Veterans, and she was sitting right next to Luke listening as he described all of those incredible experiences in World War II. As many times as you've heard this now, Diane, is there an element of Luke's story that still just really gets to you?
I think the part that touches me is because I'm a mom, and I know that on Thanksgiving Day they were told that he was missing in action, and that's not what you want to hear on Thanksgiving. And so being an only child, I can imagine the fear in his parents to know that he's possibly not coming home. And so not until they heard from the postman after reading the postcard that he was alive, I'm sure there was just a lot of prayer. They were a Christian family. And I've had so many of our veterans, and especially our POWs, tell me that they believe the reason they made it home is because they had praying mom and praying grandma. I'm just so thankful that that turned out for them, because it would be devastating to lose your only child.
Yeah, and here he is all these years later, still baking cookies for people, for goodness sake. And he's just one of, as he said, hundreds of vets that you've gotten to know. And people can go online, they can look at Forever Young Veterans, and they can learn about what you do. But I would love for you to share with our listeners where this came from, because there's a story there. And I'm sure when you started, you weren't thinking it was going to be what it's become.
You are so right. Well, my dad became an alcoholic after World War II, and I watched him suffer so much. And as a child, I remember looking at him, and I knew there was something wrong with him. I knew it wasn't a character problem, but I don't even know if he knew what it was. But one thing about my dad, he loved America, and he instilled that in me. And so I wanted to give back to the World War II veterans. That's how it began. My dad had never asked for anything from our country. And I just thought, if I could just bring a little joy into some of their lives, or maybe grant a wish for them. And that's how I started it. I wanted to just make them happy and just do some little wishes. But they didn't stay little very long. But you know, Paul, what I found out that really shocked me, and I did not expect this. As we began to grant wishes for the World War II veterans, that they were suffering just like my dad. You know, when you go through anything traumatic, you think you're the only one. And I think our family felt that way. And so as I began to work with them, I saw that they were suffering silently all these years later. And I wanted to do more than just make them happy. I wanted to help bring healing into their lives. I was not able to do it for my dad. He died young, but I could do it for his comrades. And I had no idea the path or the journey that this would take. And so as we began to grant these wishes, and I just saw their lives changing, it really healed me. And it healed their families too. That's why it was just so much more meaningful than I ever expected, because as the veterans received healing into their lives, then their relationships changed. And so many of the family members would say to me, since Dad went to Normandy, for example, he came back and he's so free. He's more outgoing. He laughs more. He's happier. We actually have a closer relationship than we've ever had. And it's like one of the World War II veterans, he was a D-Day vet, told me, he said, I didn't realize the burden I was carrying until it lifted. And so, you know, my father has a new legacy now. I mean, everyone in our small town knew he was an alcoholic. That's what he was known as. But see, now he's known for Forever Young Veterans because of his suffering. Look what has happened. We have helped bring healing because of his suffering and his PTSD. And so I'm just so thankful that I've had this ministry. I do call it a ministry because I've never taken a salary. I do this for my dad, and it's my gift to him. Mm-hmm. And I know that he's so happy that something bad from his life has turned into good for so many.
And when something's put on your heart and you start to take those steps, you don't know where it's going to lead. So when you started this 18 years ago, mm-hmm. did you have any idea how many people were going to believe in the same kind of mission and vision who are going to jump on and say, you know what, that's a really good idea, and I can help you in ways you didn't think were possible.
It's been such a shock to me. It's just like the first time we went to Washington, D.C., I never intended to take groups at all. And it just kind of happened by accident. And so I took this group to D.C., and I think in my mind it was a one-time deal. But we got back. I'm telling you, this trip was absolutely perfect. And we just saw so much healing, even just going to D.C., just them being together. And so when we got back, they told their buddies, and within 48 hours, we had 50 more veterans. And I realized at this moment that my calling was going to be a fundraiser. So I'd raise money, we'd go to D.C., we'd raise money, go to D.C. Well, then we were in Washington, D.C. one time and had a tap on my shoulder. And it was one of our Omaha Beach D-Day vets. And he said, Diane, do you know what I really want? I said, what do you really want? He goes, would you take me back to France? And I laughed. You know why I laughed? Because at this point, they were like 85 years old. And I thought, going to D.C. is one thing. Taking these elderly men out of the country, I mean, that's just a whole nother thing. And I just kind of laughed because I was thinking, well, that's impossible. Mm-hmm. So I had never had anyone ask me before to go to Normandy. Well, what do you think happened? Soon as that came out of his mouth, I started being contacted by veterans. Can you take me to Normandy? I want to go back to France. I want to go back. It was just constant. And I was going, you've got to be kidding me. So I went to church in my Sunday school class, and I stood up and I said, they always prayed for me. I said, I need you to pray because I have these veterans that want to go back to Normandy, but I don't want to do anything I shouldn't be doing. And so I need a sign from God. If I am supposed to do this, I need to know because I want them to be safe. And there's risk in doing things like that. And so I wanted to have wisdom. So that week, this gentleman called me. And he goes, Diane, will you have lunch with me? And I said, well, of course. He didn't go to our church or anything. And I had lunch with him. And he said, well, I heard that you have some veterans that are wanting to go back to France. That's one thing I've learned about seniors. They do talk. And so I said, yes. I said, I'm just looking into it. He handed me a check for $100,000. And he said, you take our boys back to Normandy.
So you took that as a sign from God.
I went, think I got my sign. And so we had the funds and we moved forward. You know, we had a medical team and we did everything possible. And, you know, we got insurance. We did everything we could to make sure they were safe. And we took our first trip to Normandy in 2011. And we just got back from the 80th, and that was our 10th trip to Normandy alone. We've been to Belgium, where the Battle of the Bulge took place. We've been there 9 times. We've been to Italy once. We've been to England once. We've been to Hawaii for Pearl Harbor with our veterans 8 times. And then we've done some individual wishes. For instance, we sent an Iwo Jima Marine back for the 70th anniversary. We've sent Okinawa Marines back for their anniversaries. So it's been quite an experience. And just getting back from Normandy, that was our 57th trip.
A long way from what you were thinking when you started out on this path. And now there's even a book that people can order and support your mission. We'll put a link for that, Forever Young Veterans.
Well, I probably never would have done the book. The reason we did it is because of the pandemic. So many of our World War II veterans were still living at home, and they were by themselves, and they were isolated. So we were very concerned about this. And so one of our board members said, why don't we take this opportunity to document their stories? And so we thought, well, you know, everything shut down. Let's try to do a book. And I just don't think it ever would have happened. So that was one good thing that came out of COVID. So Mike Ware, he was a fighter pilot in the Air Force. He's an excellent writer. I've known him for 30, maybe over 30 years. He and my husband served together at Vance Air Force Base. So he helped us get this book in fruition. So we're so thankful for him. So that's how it came to be. We have 22 stories. Most of them are World War II veterans. And we've got a few Korea and a few Vietnam vets. But now we've started working on another one. We've had such positive feedback from so many people of how much it's meant to them. I've even heard from people who would say to me, I don't have any veterans in my family. I don't know anything about wars or the military. And that book changed my life. It gave me a totally different perspective. So, you know, we've heard from all kinds of people. And so Mike Ware has agreed to help us do another one. And so we're really excited about that. But yes, Luke is in our book.
With quite a few other incredible stories. And I'm wondering about a couple things. One, what's next? What's the future look like for Forever Young Veterans? And if someone is listening to you and hearing the heart behind it and they want to support, what's the best thing for them to do?
Well, lately we have been honoring our Vietnam vets. As much as I adore the World War II and the Korea veterans, I mean, all my uncles were Korean veterans. I love these guys so much. I really didn't know a lot about the Vietnam War, even though my brother was in pilot training. He would have ended up in Vietnam if the war hadn't ended. But what I have found is these guys need us more than anyone. And when we took our very first trip to D.C. with Vietnam vets, it was so different. I didn't know how it was all going to turn out because I was used to working with World War II veterans. But I found that they were so grateful for any tiny little thing that we did. They were just starved for love and respect and our attention. And that is one thing that we do when we go on trips, is that we just shower them with honor. We do a lot of little things that just blows them away, which shows them that we truly care. You know, I think the Vietnam vets have a bad rap. You know, people, they're rough around the edges. They have an attitude. You know, they got a chip on their shoulder. I have not found that on our trips. These men and women, we have a few women, they are very patriotic. They do love this country, and they deserve so much more from us. I mean, like one of the vets said, when he was on our trip, he said, I would not wear a Vietnam hat because I was ashamed in a way because of the way people treated us. And he goes, you know what? I don't feel that way now after this trip. And he goes, I will wear my hat every single day. And I think as we talked with Luke, and there's a different perspective, you know, that we have one thing in our mind. But when we go on the trip, I think we give them a different perspective. And it's like one of the veterans told me when he got off the airplane and there were people there to applaud. And he goes, well, I just don't feel like I'm worthy of that. I don't deserve that. I said to him, you are wearing this hat, not for yourself, really. Who are you wearing this hat for? You're wearing this hat for those men and women that did not come home. And that you should have pride in that. That you are wearing this so they are never forgotten.
It reminds me of a shirt an Honor Flight friend of mine in Colorado Springs, Mark Schaefer, gave me. It says, we have an obligation to the veteran who didn't come home to honor the one who did. And you know, when we do that, there's so much healing and catharsis we start to see unfolding too.
We see their lives change. It's like one of our Texans, his wife said to him when he got off the plane, she goes, your eyes are different. What happened? Your eyes are different. I have chills even talking about it because it means so much to me because this is my dad's legacy. You know, you take your mess, whatever it is, and you make it your message. And I did an interview one time, and a producer called me up, and he said, Diane, I just have to share this with you. He said, you know how many stories we've done? Thousands and thousands and thousands. He said, I've only seen our producer cry twice. And he cried over your story. And I went, really? I mean, I don't think my story's that magnificent. Why would this bring such emotion in him? And he said, you know, he was saying, you had a hard childhood and you could be very bitter toward your dad. He goes, but you're honoring him. And he said that just moved him to tears, that you weren't a victim. And I think that's why perspective is so important. My dad suffered in the war. My dad did not want to be that way. I know he didn't. And I can respect him for his sacrifice to our country. So that's why he really is my driving force. And when I see people's lives change, it just fulfills me. It heals me. And I look up toward heaven and I say, Dad, your life mattered.
Did it ever. And thanks to Forever Young Veterans, countless vets have realized that what they did matters a whole lot more than they may have imagined. ForeverYoungVets.org is where you can learn more about the organization and find out how to support those efforts. I have that link and a link to their book for you at hometownheroesradio.com, where you can also see what Luke McLaurin looked like when he went skydiving at age 95. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.